You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is
everything.
Wasn't that a fun song?
We are so delighted that you're with us for episode 138, which we are calling Reno, the Wild West of Divorce. And we opened with a little bit from the musical 42nd Street, and you maybe recognize that Shuffle Off to Buffalo. Did you catch the lyric? Matrimony is baloney. She'll be wanting alimony in a year or so. Still they go and shuffle off to Buffalo. When she knows as much as we know, she'll be on her way to Reno. Please welcome tonight's special guest, Henry C. Park, who joins us the first Thursday of every month. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Bobby Jean. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Henry.
And Sandra V. McGee, who is joining us. Hello, Sandra.
Howdy. Good evening.
Yeah, we're delighted you're with us.
I love the music.
And our third guest is Peggy Wynn Borgman. And welcome, Peggy.
Hello. Hi, thanks, Peggy, for having us.
So we are delighted to have a full house. There's nothing like seeing so many wonderful faces on the screen. Henry, where are you joining us from tonight?
I'm back in Brooklyn, New York, the home of Billy the Kid. Well, the birthplace of Billy the Kid.
Not Billy the Kid. And Sandra, where are you tonight?
I'm in Napa Valley, California.
All right. And Miss Peggy, where are you tonight?
Carson City, Nevada, just down the road from Reno.
Right where we're talking about, almost.
Well, our listeners are probably wondering, what's up with Rendezvous with a Writer? What are they talking about? So, Jim was going to start with just a little bit of a bio for Sandra, followed by for Peggy, so that you all kind of know who these ladies are and what we'll be talking about. Do you want to go ahead and get
Let's do it. Okay. Sandra V. McGee launched her writing career as a publicist for the performing arts. In 2000, she ventured into her late husband, William L. McGee's bygone world of Nevada's divorce ranches. She recently released a new edition of his memoir, The Divorce Seekers, the intimate true story of a Nevada divorce ranch wrangler. This is going to be fun.
Okay, and now Peggy, tell us a little something about Peggy.
Peggy Wynn Borgman is a writer, editor, and artist based in Northern Nevada. Her novels Windfall, The Better Half, and the upcoming Fire Season are inspired by the lives of women in the West and set in his unforgettable landscapes. Tonight, we're taking an in-depth look at The Better Half, a gripping novel set against the backdrop of a 1952 Nevada divorce ranch.
Oh, welcome ladies. And Henry Park is with us the first Thursday of every month. And we love having Henry on with us. And Henry, do you want to go ahead and share this month's Henry's Western Roundup?
It would be my pleasure. And happy to say I've got some very interesting new Westerns to tell you about. Now available for rent or on Amazon Prime or on DVD from Twin Engines Global is Was Once a Hero. Set in the 1890s, a traumatized sister and brother are traveling through the forest trying to evade the men who killed their father. They form a desperate alliance with a wandering old man, a former major who suffers from the combined effects of age, injuries, and the horrors of the Civil War. Today, we'd call it PTSD. He's trying to lead them to a vaguely remembered town where they'll be safe. It's a moving character study between the girl, played by Julie Cashmanian, and the major, Darby Hinton, who played Israel, Fess Parker's son, on the Daniel Boone series. And Robert Carradine is in it as well. It's written by Dan Searles and Paige Smith and directed by Michael Tuttle. On NBC Universal's Zumo Play, a free streamer that I wasn't aware of before this, is The Wide West, the fourth Western starring Russian-born three-time Mr. Universe Alexander Nevsky. Like the other three, this one is a collaboration between Nevsky, director Joe Cornette, and screenwriter Craig Hammond, and a bit more lighthearted than the others. And it's suggested by turn-of-the-century true events. Following the Russo-Japanese War, whose end was mediated by President Teddy Roosevelt, a delegation of sumo wrestlers come to the U.S. to meet the president. When en route, they arrive in a Western town controlled by a ruthless outlaw gang. They join forces with a professional gambler, played by Nevsky. This one's so new, I got it today and only got to see the first 10 minutes. It looks like a lot of fun so far.
That's quite wrong.
He's got such a fun job, doesn't he?
I do. Now, on a much more serious note, I just yesterday interviewed Ryan Flynn, director of the documentary You're No Indian, which I've watched twice and cannot recommend too strongly. It's about the very troubling practice of tribal disenrollment, where Indigenous people are abruptly told by their tribal leaders that their credentials aren't good enough and they're out. And because each tribe is a sovereign nation, the federal government has no jurisdiction, so there's no due process, no civil rights. Despite going to such lengths as exhuming ancestors' bodies for DNA tests and proving their connection, thousands of Indigenous people have been disenrolled and lost their homes, their jobs, their identities. And it all comes down to casino profits. This is only happening among tribes that own casinos. And the more members a tribe can kick out, the more money each remaining member gets. You're No Indian is narrated by Tantu Cardinal, and she and Academy Award winner Wes Studi are executive producers.
Wow.
It premieres June 28th in Los Angeles, and as soon as I learn more about where it's available, I'll spread the word. Now, it is, frankly, a very upsetting movie to watch, but it's very well done. And the director really gives both sides a chance to explain. You know, it is very open-minded, I think, but I'd be amazed if you didn't come out on the director's side. Anyway, the current True West, the May-June issue, focuses on the fact and fiction behind the Netflix series American Primeval. Yes, I still haven't got my copies.
We'll send you one.
We got you, Henry.
And, of course, at the center of that is the Mountain Meadows Massacre, where a group of Mormons slaughtered a wagon train. Has anybody seen it?
Oh, have you? All right.
Yeah. Now, the history of the show, not just the show, is very controversial among historians. The show is very bloody. A close-up almost always means a scalping or a throat slitting is coming. But it's very exciting, and it's accomplished something we all try to do. It's a hit with a huge young audience, as in under 50. I have four articles in this issue, oddly enough. A review, an interview with the screenwriter, a look at Mormons in the movies, an interview with the film's Indigenous expert, and interviews with the actors who play the most interesting characters, Shea Whigham as Jim Bridger and Kim Coates as Brigham Young. Oh, I've got a new article on the INSP Network's blog, Westerns at the Drive-In. And 2 days ago, I interviewed our mutual friend, Western history expert Peter Shirako.
Peter.
That's for an upcoming INSP Network blog. Whoops, I lost my spot there. INSP Network article for the National Day of the Cowboy. And please check out the new Henry's Western Roundup, featuring my interview with the star and director of the exceptional Australian Western, the legend of Molly Johnson, and my memories of working with the late, great Joe Don Baker. And you can read all about this and so much more at henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
All right. Oh, we're up to date now.
Yes.
I think we are.
Yeah, we're up to date now.
I actually finally got through the second year of 1923.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
It's taken me a while. Yeah, and Bobby hasn't seen it.
You give away too much. Right?
Yeah. We
lost one character in there. I was very disappointed. We decided that person had to go. Now, the way we handled it was pretty good.
Don't be doing any spoiler alerts.
That's about as much as I can say.
Well, Henry, we're so delighted as always to have you with us and to have you with us tonight for this very special discussion about the divorce ranches of Reno. And I know you probably know about some movies that maybe use this as subject matter. Yes, do you, Henry?
Oh, absolutely. Although I have to say that I have learned a whole lot more about that from Sandra's book, because she has a wonderful index.
Yes, she does.
Movies, because I thought, whoa, yeah, I'm so smart. I know like three, and she's got 40.
go ahead.
It's what I do.
The one that I think we all are, and most, a lot of at least your viewers will be familiar with, of course, is The Women, which I did not know until I read the book that Claire Booth Luce got the idea while she was going through a divorce and staying there. And it's such now I've seen it on stage and loved it on stage, loved the movie. And I think it really benefits from the fact that Claire Booth Luce, L-U-C-E, and the screenwriter, Anita Luce, L-O-O-S, are probably the two wittiest women in the history of Hollywood. It is just such a charming picture.
As according to my research, Claire Booth Luce wrote the play in 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah. I've read that from several different sources, so it's probably true or close to the truth, which is amazing because the dialogue is fantastic.
Yeah. Before we go to our very first little break, I'm just looking at our time and we're good on time. Sandra, I'm going to hold up the book. And will you just take a moment and just tell us very briefly a little bit about where this book came from? Or something.
That you're looking at the second edition. The first edition was published 20 years ago. The idea for the book came from my late husband. And when I met him, my only knowledge of the divorce ranch era was from the movie The Women. I grew up in North Hollywood and, you know, I'm a movie person. And to meet a real life cowboy who worked on a ranch like that, I couldn't believe it. I was fascinated. And I kept asking him questions and tell me more. And, you know, I said, Bill, you really have to write about this and I want to help you. I think I became more passionate about the subject than he was because he lived through it. But that's how I got into it. And I wanted to comment on something Henry said, that at presentations that I've given and Peggy and I have given, we ask how many people have seen the movie The Women. Not many raise their hands, considering that it's on Turner Classic Movie, like every Turner Classic Movies, maybe every other month or so. So this current generation, not us, but they haven't seen the movie. So we need to bring it out.
Yeah.
Well, good you mentioned that. Maybe somebody listening will pass it on. They will see it and pass it on to their friends.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And Peggy, we're going to have you kind of do the same thing. If you would just take a moment. We're going to be talking about both these books in greater detail. But tell us a little bit about The Better Half, a novel of the Nevada divorce ranch era.
Yes. Well, the better half owes its inspiration to the divorce seekers. And it was the result of encountering that book that got me interested in the subject matter. I live literally just down the road from where the Flying Emmy Ranch was. And I just found it captivating subject matter. I also spent 10 years on the board of a domestic violence agency in the Bay Area. And that topic has always been interesting to me. And I found a way to sort of bring a new interest and an old interest together in developing the plot for this book. And it also includes more local history that just sort of found its way in there too. There's a lot to write about here in Northern.
Yes. Canada. Yes. And we chose based on information from Sandra's book, we chose to sprinkle in a little music tonight. And her book covers 1947 and 1949. So we're going to take our first break. And this is our way of thanking our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. Are you a writer? Are you considering taking your book on the road this summer? Do you need assistance planning that trip? Maybe you'd like to increase your social media presence or refresh your website. Our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, are standing by to assist you. Contact them to make your summer and fall plans. When we come back, you'll enjoy music from the 1947 number one song on the hit parade, Old Buttermilk Sky, and we'll begin our in-depth look at tonight's topic, Reno, the Wild West of Divorce. We'll be right back. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experience, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com. Okay, we're back. Sam, do you have Old Buttermilk Sky on tap?
Old Buttermilk Sky, don't you fail me when I'm needing you most. Hang a moon above a hitching post. Hitch me to the one I love. You can if you try, don't tell me no lie. Will you be mellow and bright tonight? Oh, buttermilk sky.
I've just been listening to Old Buttermilk Sky. Hoagie Carmichael. Yeah. We go back a long time on that one.
We love Sam. Sam Hassan, owner of LA Talk Radio, and our show's producer is a DJ tonight. And we thank him so much for helping us get the music together. So, yes, so we are back. And I know we did just do a little recap from both books, but now I think we want to learn a little bit more about what is a divorce ranch. A little, you know, what was their history, a little bit about that. Sandra, do you want to talk about that or set a little of that up and have Peggy tell us more? You guys figure that out. Who wants to take the lead?
Peggy does a better job than I do. In fact, she does such a good job that I asked her to write the introduction to the second edition. But I want to just backtrack for a few seconds, and because I did not say that Bill was the wrangler on this divorce ranch, the Flying ME, from 1947 to 1949. I didn't really set the stage for that. But Peggy, you do a fabulous job of setting the stage.
Thank you, Sandra. Yeah, well, it's such captivating subject matter, and I just found it endlessly fascinating. So what happened, what kind of led to the creation of these? It really goes back to close to the turn of the century in Nevada, because the migratory divorce business had been created a while before mid-century America, when both of our stories are set. And in 1931, because of the Great Depression and the fact that the gold and silver booms were over for Nevada, the legislature, which meets only every other year here, passed two laws. So it's the wide open casino gambling law. And they shortened the residency requirement just this week for divorce. So it had started at 6 months, went down to 3 months, went down to 6 weeks. So in order to get a divorce in Nevada, you had to be here for 6 weeks. You needed a witness to swear in court they'd seen you at least once every 24 hours during that period. Mm-hmm. And you had to cite one of nine legal justifications for your divorce. And it could be insanity, abandonment, gross drunkenness, which suggests there's something other than gross drunkenness. Yeah. Mental cruelty, impotence. Yeah. So anyhow, all you needed is one of those and you would be able to get your divorce. You also had to state to the court that you intended to remain in Nevada and make it your home, which of course was a big wink, wink fiction for a lot of the people that came here for divorce. So over time, Reno became the divorce capital of America. Because back then, you couldn't get a divorce on demand. And we have almost all forgotten this. And this is the fact that people just can't believe when they talk to us about this era is, what do you mean you weren't able to get a divorce if you wanted one? That was the case. And Nevada, in making residency so brief, became a magnet for people who wanted a divorce. So where do people stay in Nevada for 6 weeks while you're getting your divorce? Well, we just talked about Claire Booth Luce. She spent her 6 weeks at the Riverside Hotel, which was right next to the Washoe County Courthouse, conveniently enough. So we had Hollywood people. We had just everyday working stiff. So the accommodations went from long-term stay hotels. That Riverside Hotel was actually built as a divorce hotel. So you had a kitchen, it was basically an extended stay type of hotel. You had motels, still a lot of them that exist here, boarding houses, private homes. And there's stories of people coming home back to their private home that they'd rented to someone and finding it completely redecorated. And the term, the biggest little city, was coined because there were so many well-to-do people and celebrities coming to Reno to get their divorce that they provided all kinds of amenities and world-class dining and entertainment. And it was Las Vegas before Las Vegas was Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So the most exclusive place you could stay was the horse ranch.
Peggy,
Oh,
could I just interject back to your point about how people don't realize today how difficult it used to be to get a divorce? In South Carolina, for example, divorce was prohibited for any reason at all from 1878 to 1949. You could not get divorced in South Carolina. In New York, it took a year. And you had to prove adultery. And that was the case up until 1967. So, you know, for we women and for some men, they were pretty much trapped if they couldn't meet these very difficult requirements. That's why Reno became like, you know, the magnet for divorce. I'm sorry, Peggy.
Well, it's okay. That's really important. And I also can mention that divorce laws in the United States are becoming more restrictive.
They are now.
So
yes.
The trend is shifting back toward more restrictive laws, particularly where it concerns pregnant women. So it's a really interesting thing. There's four different.
How long did it take to get a divorce in Reno?
Today?
Back then, you had to do your 6 weeks. Then you got your appointment. You know, you had 6 weeks to establish a residency. You had your court date set. So people were, they had timed it down to the minute practically. So as soon as your residency requirement, that box was ticked, you were already set by your divorce lawyer to be in the courtroom. And they actually had these special small courtrooms that were in the Washoe County Courthouse just for divorce. It was an assembly line of divorce hearings.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, is there I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to go back to the flying ME where Bill McGee worked. So if you wanted to stay away from prying eyes and publicity, you stayed at a divorce ranch. That's where you had discretion, security. There were reporters hanging around Reno trying to catch famous people and rich people getting divorces. So the divorce ranch gave you privacy. And it also gave you... freedom that you probably hadn't known, because the primary guest type there were, oh, they were well-heeled society women and girls from the East Coast who were getting divorces. In some cases, they might have been there more than once. And as Sandra's told me, you needed references to get in. You know, they didn't just accept anybody. You needed references. And it was a small group of people.
Emmy Wood, the proprietor of the Flying ME, she needed to know you or your family before she would let you stay on the ranch. But I wanted to say about the privacy of the ranches that some of the stringers, as they were known, the reporters that were paid to stay in Reno from the East Coast papers, some of the stringers actually tried to bribe employees or staff of the divorce ranches to what's in socialite Sandra's lingerie drawer, you know. And, you know, these stories were considered tabloid news. And according to Bill, none of the staff at the Flying ME could be bribed to even say who was staying on the ranch at any particular time.
Yeah. Peggy, did you have a section from
Clark Gable?
Peggy, do you have a section from your book that you wanted to read?
I've got a section. The book. Are we hearing from Sandra first on a reading, or
no? We're going to Sandra and Henry are in the next section. Peggy, can you hear us?
Missed what you just said, Bobby.
Well,
I can now. I think we had a little bandwidth.
Yes, a little bit.
Oh, you're freezing up from time to time, unfortunately.
Mm. Yes. So I think both Sandra and I were really taken with this idea of this East Coast luxury upper crust colliding with the Old West. And in my book, my protagonist is a woman who has, she was an Indian school runaway who's reinvented herself as a socialite, never intended to return to Nevada, but she's had to do it to get her divorce. And she is staying on a luxurious divorce ranch that was inspired by the Flying ME, but she's getting a little itchy and impatient, and she wants to go out and on the town and have some fun, even though she's being pursued by her husband. So they are up in Virginia City at the Bucket of Blood Saloon. And she has brought the ranch's bookkeeper with her for a wingman, essentially. The Bucket of Blood Saloon was stuffed with people. The patrons were drinking and singing and shouting to be heard. And to my surprise, no one batted an eye at the sight of two women in fancy evening dresses. We had made a much bigger impression at the swanky Riverside. I followed Helene across the plank floor, and she surprised me by walking up to the bar and pulling out a stool. I climbed up and arranged the fluffy skirts of the dress as best I could so they wouldn't touch the patron on the stool next to mine. He didn't notice because he was too busy arguing with the man sitting at his right about what else gold mining. That claim isn't played out, yelled the older of the two. You'll see. You were had, declared the one closest to me. The barkeep looked like a trapped hornet moving furiously back and forth behind the huge mahogany bar. He gave us an impatient look. What'll it be? It was the first time I'd seen a man perfectly unimpressed by Helene, and from the smile on her face, I could tell she appreciated that. Bottle of your best whiskey and two glasses, Helene said, like we were a couple of gunslingers in a Western. In a jiffy, he set it all down in front of us. Stone-faced, he poured a finger of whiskey into each glass. I couldn't help it. I giggled. It was all so silly, these odd people pretending they lived in the Old West. Helene added more whiskey to my glass and poured herself a little more. Cheers! She clinked her glass to mine, just like that, tossed it back. Helene was sure a queer thing, fancy and stuck up as you please, but with the manners of a sailor on leave. That's better. She reached toward the bottle to pour another. Allow me, offered an elegantly dressed man standing to Helene's left. She smiled her kitty cat smile and peered up at him through her thick eyelashes. Another man, younger and more handsome, sat on a stool next to him and gave us a charming smile. He wore a wide-striped sateen jacket and underneath that a flowered waistcoat like a riverboat gambler. The pair looked like they'd just stepped out of a Gilbert and Sullivan number. I could see that Helene was intrigued by them, too. Ladies, you are a sight for sore eyes this evening, declared the whiskey-pouring man, a very tall fellow. He seemed delighted, as if they'd been anticipating our arrival. He had the face of an accountant, but he was dressed like a dandy. Despite his size, he carried himself as if he'd never heard about the law of gravity. He picked up Helene's hand and kissed it. Lucius Beebe, at your service, he announced. And this is my partner, Charles Clegg. Helene, she said in a teasing drawl, as if her first name said it all. Cherchez la femme. Mr. Beebe looked tickled to death. He turned to the younger man, presenting Helene like she was a magician's assistant he'd just made reappear. Helen of Troy ounces, he said with a smile. I had no idea what he meant by that, but the three of them tossed back their heads and laughed like old friends. You can't possibly be Lucius Beebe, teased Helene, nestling up against the bar, all coy, her eyes gleaming. He lives in New York. He did, said the man and glanced at his friend. And naturally, we still keep an apartment there. But as I always say, it's best to leave the party when it's still good. Cafe society has vanished into the mists, or the soot, as the case may be. Once we discovered that there was a splendid Victorian saloon for every 20 residents of this town, we knew we'd found Mecca.
That is Peggy Wynn Borgman, who just read from The Better Half. We are going to take a very quick break. And we're going to step away for a moment to tell you about one of the places you can order the books tonight of Henry's and Sandra's and Peggy's. Find their books on the Out West Shop affiliate page at bookshop.org. And when we come back, we are going to have another reading from the other book, and we'll enjoy the number one song of the 1948 hit parade, Buttons and Bows. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
I love you in buckskin or skirts that you've homespun. But I love you longer, stronger, where your friends don't tote a gun. My bones denounce the buckboard bounce and the cactus hurts my toes. Let's vamoose where the gals keep using those silks and satins and linen that shows. And you're all mine in buttons and bows.
That was fun.
Well, yeah, so welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We used to listen to Buttons and Bows and sung by the great guy, Gene Autry. We're talking about divorce ranches. And in your book, Sandra, you have some, there's some, just some great stories. And I think there was one about Clark Gable and Ava Gardner. And somebody was going to read that one.
Sanja.
Yes, I wanted to explain that I'm drinking a Dubonnet cocktail.
Okay.
Which was the cocktail of choice by Emmy Wood, the proprietor of the Flying Emmy. And it was when it was her time to entertain the guests at night and take them drinking and gambling somewhere, one of their favorite watering holes. Emmy said that she could sip on two all night and, quote, be fit as a fiddle to drive the guests back to the ranch. One of the frequent guests on the Flying Emmy was Clark Gable, not to get a divorce, but to get away in between movies and get away from Hollywood. And it's a popular chapter when people find out that Bill knew Clark Gable. Never mind Bill's story, they wanted to hear about Clark Gable. So that's the chapter you'll be listening to. However, my attempts at trying to sound like a cowboy, despite coaching lessons from a fellow writer who's also an actress, failed miserably. So Henry is going to do me and Bill, who I'm sure is listening, the honor. And Henry's going to read Ava Gardner, Clark Gable, and me.
Okay. And thank you very much. I really appreciate the honor. So Clark Gable and Ava Gardner and me. Clark Gable may have been the king in Hollywood, but on the Flying Emmy, he wanted to be just Clark. He loved Emmy Wood and stopped by the ranch frequently to say hello and have a drink, or stay a few days to get away from Hollywood. Edie and Effie adored him for his good manners and lack of airs, and he treated them not to, and he trusted them not to leak his presence to the press. He always arrived in some sporty automobile and took pleasure in washing it each morning. He liked to tend bar for the guests. When he shook their martinis and Manhattans, that lock of hair fell on his forehead and the ladies loved it. Clark and I were like buddies. He wanted to go to my cowboy hangouts and I took him to Roaring Camp and the Roundup Bar. The patrons recognized him, but other than a friendly nod, they let him be. It was said Clark was still in mourning for the loss of his beloved wife, actress Carol Lombard. In 1942, Carol and her mother were flying home from Indiana to California after a national campaign to sell war bonds. Minutes after taking off in Las Vegas, their plane crashed. There were no survivors. Clark didn't talk about it, at least not with me. In 1947, Clark Gable met Ava Gardner on the set of The Hucksters, and they became instant friends. Clark told Ava about the Flying Emmy, and it became one of her favorite getaways from Hollywood. Now, I had a big crush on Ava Gardner. I thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world, even more beautiful in person than in the movies. And that voice, soft and sexy with a hint of a North Carolina drawl. Like Clark Gable, when Ava Gardner was on the ranch, she didn't want special treatment. In the fall of 48, Clark and Ava happened to be on the ranch at the same time. He suggested the three of us go pheasant hunting in Carson Valley. He drove his Caddy convertible, with Ava seated between him and me in the front seat. She wore blue jeans and a man's white shirt, unbuttoned, just enough to expose a modest view of cleavage. I couldn't believe I was sitting next to this ravishing woman, our knees touching. Furthermore, she was in between marriages from her second husband, bandleader Artie Shaw, they divorced in 46, and her third husband, Frank Sinatra, they would marry in 51. Her first husband was actor Mickey Rooney. They married in 42 and divorced the next year. After pheasant hunting, Clark, Ava, and I stopped at the Genoa Bar. We walked in and heads turned. There were whispers down the bar. That's Clark Gable. That's Ava Gardner. Who's that guy with them? The bartender bought our drinks, and Clark gave him the two pheasants he bagged. Someone snapped a photo of the three of us, and I'm still hoping to find it. The last time I saw Clark Gable was in September 1960. It was in Reno on business. I was in Reno on business and stopped by the Flying Emmy to say hello to Emmy. Who should answer the door but the king himself? He was in the area shooting The Misfits. Well, hell, Bill, come on in, he said, drink in hand. He was wearing a Lee denim jacket he'd bought at Parker's. When filming wrapped on The Misfits, Clark was quoted as saying, working with Marilyn Monroe nearly gave me a heart attack. Sadly, 2 months later, on November 16, 1960, Clark Gable suffered a fatal heart attack at age 59. He never saw the final version of The Misfits. In 2013, I read in the papers that the Lee denim jacket sold at auction for $6,543.60.
Oh, Henry Park reading story. From The Divorce Seekers, the fabulous chapter about Clark Gable.
Jacket probably cost $4.95 at Parker's.
The Genoa Bar, and in Nevada, it's called the Genoa Bar. I lived in Genoa briefly. Is still a magnet for filmmakers, yeah. And actually was featured in Misery.
Oh, all yeah. Okay.
And The Shootist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in fact, the house from The Shootist is a few blocks from mine. Right. That was John Wayne's last film.
You know, as Jim and I read both books and have been talking over the last several days, you know, why is this not a series? I mean, this is the perfect material for a series, and go ahead and set it in this time period, the late 40s, stretch it into the 50s, right, ladies? You have beautiful landscapes. You've got drama and comedy. You have a cast of characters, the folks that are on the ranch and providing all the services. You've got the pawnbroker in town. You've got Parker's shop. You've got, they go to Carson City and they go over to Virginia City. You have all kinds of activities,
that's
right?
True.
And you have characters that could show up and be there for 6 weeks and then go get the divorce. And you could have characters like Clark Gable that just want to be there for a few days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but this is a hit already. This is,
well,
Bobby, you're hired as our publicist, Bobby, and Henry, you're hired as our voiceover on the commercials. Well, you know, there's two actors, do I say their names, Peggy, who are promoting, I do?
No.
No, who are promoting film production and television production in Nevada right now. So, perhaps with their rather, you know, they're making a lot of effort to get more film production in that state. And, you know, maybe that will inspire someone to take up the mantle on this. But Peggy and I couldn't agree with you more. We definitely see it as a ongoing series.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What's remarkable, too, is how many locations are still in existence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be very easy to reproduce that time period. I was in Reno the other day, and some of these 40s, 50s motels there's a whole street full of them that are still
Yeah. Well, we were talking about Parker's a moment ago, which is where everybody went to get their Out West outfit. So let's hear a word from our sponsor, Jim and me, with our Out West shop.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll hear a little bit from the number one song in 1949. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw a-plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw.
Yeah, Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Lon Monroe.
Lon Monroe.
I didn't realize that song was that old. I was actually surprised that it was.
Yeah, Stan Smith wrote that about 49 or something.
Stan Jones. It is a classic. And how fun that it is so fun about the divorce seekers that at the beginning of each sort of era, that each year, Sandra gives us some fun sort of trivia to set the tone.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if anyone would read that. I had it in. I took it out. I put it in.
No.
So, but I felt it was important to set the stage historically. When things took place on the ranch.
You're bringing in a great context. It, you know, you just know where you are and when you are.
Thank you.
I am looking at time and we are almost out, but I want to be sure. Henry, was there anything you wanted to be sure to add to conversation tonight? Was there, you know, any, you always have a good comment or two.
I'll quickly have my questions. I was curious. I wanted to ask Sandra, seeing as this is a new edition of your book after 20 years, I was wondering what sort of changes you made from the original.
One of the changes I made, and this was in conversation with Peggy, I did not have my sounding board anymore because Bill had passed away. So Peggy was my sounding board. She knew about the period of time. And one of the things that Peggy suggested was the first edition had a lot of history, kind of off topic, you might say, sidebars, 6 pages of the history of Glenbrook. And Peggy suggested stripping that away and focusing on Bill's story. And so that's what I did. I brought in some new stories and I redesigned the layout of the book completely. So the second edition is more like a magazine. I actually stole some ideas from Noir City, don't tell Eddie Mueller. And so it's like a magazine you can, you know, flip through and look at the pictures.
Sandra,
or read this.
Sandra, would you just touch on the history of the photos in the book? I know we don't have a lot of time, but I think that's one of the most fascinating.
Well, from interviewing people, and once again, I'm to blame for this, you might say. When we started writing the book, it was going to be a 6x9 with about 20 pictures from Bill's scrapbook. But the internet was not really what it is now. There was only Ancestry.com. And I started trying to find if any of these people were alive that were guests on the ranch. They weren't, but I started to find their children. And that's how we gathered a lot of photographs that are in the book from scrapbooks that these families had. And I still have the photos. I need to put them in an archive someday, but I have a hard time letting go of them.
And you had a real treasure trove from one guest in particular.
Oh, yes. Valerie Vandermeule, you're thinking of. She was the first guest Bill met on the ranch, Valerie Vandermeule. She was editor at Life magazine. And Valerie came out with her typewriter and her camera and spent most of her 6 weeks taking photographs. I found her brother on the internet. And one night at 9 o'clock, the phone rings. And I said to Bill, don't answer it. It's so late. It was her brother calling from Connecticut. He found Valerie's scrapbook from the Flying ME with about 200 black and white photographs. And that changed the whole concept of our book.
Yeah.
We are so delighted to have had you all tonight. Yeah. Very quickly, we are like almost out of time. Henry, where can people find you and follow you, Henry?
Oh, you can find me at henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com and on Facebook, also Henry's Western Roundup. And you can look for my book, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made and the People Who Made Them.
And Sandra, where can people find and follow you?
I'm at McGeeBooks.com. My books are on Amazon, and I'm on Facebook at Sandra McGee Author.
Wonderful. And Peggy?
PWBorgman.com. That is my pen name. And my books are available through Amazon, bookshop.org. and Barnes & Noble, where I just got to do a little book signing in Reno.
Oh, that's cool. Next week, our featured guest is Jeff Crawford. He writes, he's prolific, over 50 books. We'll be talking about his newest series of 5 books, Marshall Mackay Gold, A Western Adventure, and we'll talk about all 5 of them. And Henry, again, thank you so much, all 3 of you, for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We can do a quote, I don't think.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Thank you. We'll see you down the trail.
Thank you very much. It's a lot of fun.
Happy trails.
Happy trails.